Say hello on Twitter at Richard Serrett. S-Y, because I love you, R-E-T-T. The world's first monkey-pig hybrids have been born, which could pave the way for human organs grown by animals. A groundbreaking experiment produced creatures with hearts, livers, spleens, lungs, and skin, which contain pig and primate cells. Stem cells from macaque monkeys were grown in a lab and then injected into pig embryos 5 days after fertilization. Of more than 4,000 implanted in sows, 10 piglets were born, but only two were chimeras, and both died in a week. However, the Chinese scientists reckon that may be due to an IFV procedure. Beijing-based Tang Hai said, "This is the first report of full-term pig-monkey chimeras." All right, get ready. Something wicked this way comes, folks. Back to more of my conversation with filmmaker Christopher Garitano as we continue to discuss the Montauk Chronicles right here on Coast to Coast AM. Chris, many of us are familiar with the Bourne films, this series of American action thriller films, which were based on the character Jason Bourne, this CIA assassin suffering from dissociative amnesia. It was played by Matt Damon in the movies. I think there were three or four films. There was the Bourne Supremacy, the Bourne Ultimatum, the Bourne Legacy. How much of that do you think is based on what happened at Montauk? Was Jason Bourne, this character, a Montauk boy?
Oh, yeah. I mean, these things were really happening. And the thing is, if you look back 30 years, 40 years, even more, go back to John Frankenheimer's Manchurian Candidate. You know, go a little further forward to, you know, a lot of things that Stephen King was writing, everything from Firestarter, go to David Cronenberg's Scanners. All of these were about government programs trying to enhance one kind or another of psychic abilities or superhuman enhancement. We just did a whole episode for Strange World on super soldiers. Everything from enhancing psychic abilities to physical abilities to enhancing with different animal DNA. This is all real. That stuff was confirmed. You know, we were talking to people that were working for DARPA. I mean, like, this is really happening. And so we know it's not far-fetched. It's really happening. And it obviously began somewhere. And it began in programs like the Montauk Project. We haven't been able to prove it 100% yet, but it's going to happen. And these other programs did happen. And so, yeah, you know, these fictional stories aren't so fictional. They were all taken from something. They were all taken from some kind of real thing that was happening. And there are those that believe those stories in fiction were put out there to kind of condition us to get used to stuff like this. Because eventually, one way or another, it's going to be sold to the public. Some of these abilities will be available to us, and I think in a form of some kind of implanted chip. And then there are others that believe that that's a conspiracy in itself.
How many Montauk boys are out there, perhaps waiting to be, I don't know, deprogrammed, maybe having memories regained through regression therapy? How many are out there ready to tell their story?
Right. Well, I've heard a variety of stories over the years. Many are dead. Some are out there telling their tale. Some are damaged, you know, wanting to tell their tale and are perhaps no longer afraid, like this gentleman that I spoke with. He used an alias, James Bruce. And then others, according to the gentleman like Preston Nichols and Al Bielek, others have been in society for a long time. They're currently either in the CIA, higher positions in the military, or high positions in politics. And that's what they claim. Again, I have no proof of this, but I wouldn't consider it as bunk, because after what I've learned over the years, I mean, any of this is possible. It all happened anyway, one place or another.
All right, let's go to the phone calls. Wildcard line, Mayad is in New York. Mayad, welcome to Coast AM.
Yes, good morning, gentlemen. I'm so glad. Boy, was I disappointed when you last got off the air about this. A three-parter, and I'll listen over the air. First, Chris, I'd like you to delve into and elaborate what happened in Holmesburg Prison. And we know that they have a certain targeted population in our prisons, and I'd like you to elaborate and explain more about the type of experiment. Secondly, I understand, I remember reading Preston's book, I believe it was, but that was some time ago. But weren't there alleged space jumps or a type of space elevator going to Mars and thereabouts, and whether that's related to Montauk? And the last and third part is you just mentioned about famous politicians being connected to being actually involved in this activity. I believe Coase had a program a few years ago, someone who was talking about Obama and even some other famous names or that person having experience it with Obama, having gone through time travel and or space bumps. And if you have my three questions and concerns, I'll listen over the air.
All right, Mayad, thank you so much for that. So let's start with the Holmesburg Prison in Philadelphia. What was going on there back in the late, well, I guess it started around 63 in the height of the Cold War. What was going on there?
Okay, so Alan Hornblum later blew the whistle on this and discovered all of the fact. He's an author, investigator, and this has been proven. So we'll go backwards now. And so what was happening was there were, under false pretenses, officials that came down there saw the gentlemen who were in prison. One gentleman we spoke to who was a survivor of this, his name is Yusuf, he was there. They came down and said, we want to test some bubble bath on you. This is for products, you know, Johnson & Johnson. And he said, well, we're going to paint it on your skin and we're going to test your skin. And he said they had this bandage on him. And he was, you know, they paid him $20. And so he's in his cell, and this stuff is burning his skin, burning. And he's screaming for help, saying, hey, man, get this thing off of me, screaming loud, loud, loud. This is just one example. And so he took this thing off of him and put it on the wall and claimed that it was eating the paint off the wall after it severely burned his skin. It's supposed to be bubble bath. And yeah, you could have a reaction to something like that, but it was later discovered that all of this stuff was part of a covert experiment leading to mind control. Yusuf was also brought in to a heavily psychedelic drug experiment where his mind was being manipulated, and that these were mind control experiments, and that Alan Hornblum did confirm that that this group was trying to make them into Manchurian candidate type assassins, or they were experimenting on these prisoners to see what it would do. And there's enough evidence to support this in the series of his books, everything from the physical chemical experiments on the skin to the mind control experiments. And you can find all of that through this incredible author. But that was happening for years. And there were alike programs going on all over the place.
Yes, Allen Memorial Hospital up here in Montreal, where women were being admitted to hospital ostensibly for postpartum depression, and they had their memories erased. They were subjected to electroconvulsive therapy and massive doses of LSD. They had their memories erased. This was done with the complicity of the Canadian government. The program was sponsored by the CIA, and if people think that this is just conspiracy theory, they were out-of-court settlements. Civil trials resulted in millions of dollars being paid to these families. They admitted in court that this was done.
Right. Our governments were complicit in all of it, and they were fully aware of what it was going to do to people and how expendable they thought people were. It was all part of the gig. They knew it. But what was the end game? What was the ultimate goal in all of this? You know, what was being developed? And it seemed to be happening in unison. You know, it was happening everywhere. So this lends credence to our paranoia and our fears of this other level of intelligence that collectively is planning or against us one way or another, or to manipulate us, to control us. And I don't think it's that crazy to believe in this stuff, because we have so much to support it. And that's what's frustrating sometimes when you come across a non-believer.
Maya had also asked about the connection between Montauk and this alleged Mars space jump that was also centered there.
Right. They did say that. They said that was there. They said there was space jumps, interstellar jumps. Al Bielek described it as a biorhythmic form of transport. So they would pinpoint one place in time and space, and they would have a number to the location, a number to the host or the traveler, and instantaneously you would be brought to this other place. And a lot of the time they said, whether it be walking through this Stargate, which was literally what you think it is, people would disappear, and they would shove Montauk boys through these things. Now, again, this is their story. I'm not saying I believe it 100%, and I'm not saying it's been confirmed, but this is what these gentlemen were telling. What we're close to proving is that there was at the very least a base underneath Montauk. Now, if there was a facility underneath that they claim wasn't there, then we can prove other things, or at least start to.
All right. Let's say hi to Jan in Brooklyn, New York, on the wild card line. Jan, welcome to Coast to Coast.
Hi. I met all three of those gentlemen at lectures. I used to go to the New Life lecture, and I also met them at a Menzer lecture.
What year was that, Jan? That was in the 80s, right?
Probably.
When you say you met all three, you met Preston Nichols, Al Bielek, and Duncan Cameron.
Yeah, I met them separately. I met Duncan and Al together and Preston Nichols separately. And Preston Nichols used to have these workshops at New Life, and I used to take them every time. Every 6 months they had it. And at the last workshop, he made a statement where he wasn't allowed to speak anymore. And to my amazement, at that workshop, all he did was play music. And he never showed up at New Life ever again. And with Al Bielek and Duncan, Duncan's memory was actually like lost. He couldn't function like a normal person. They sort of, that was in the Philadelphia experiment. So he was like a shell of a human being, Duncan was.
That's interesting, because I tried to interview Duncan Cameron once for an episode of a TV show I was hosting. And same thing, he could not maintain a thread, sort of a cohesive thread. He could not answer questions because he wasn't there. Anyway, did you have anything to add to that, Christopher?
It's always wonderful to hear someone who is authentically there during that time, you know, because this is before the book was written. A lot of the time these people went to these gatherings and they were unique. You know, it was before the internet. It was before there was this word of mouth communication. You know, and what an interesting time to hear people's stories, or just to talk to someone who is authentically at those meetings. I've been able to just find very few over the years. It's wonderful to speak to you, Jan, and hear from you.
Do you think then, Christopher, that the Duncan Cameron, Preston Nichols, and Al Bielek, maybe they were part of Montauk, but they were damaged. They were programmed as disinfo agents to spread this cover story about time travel and aliens and all that. Because once you start bringing that up, let's face it, you lose the room with a lot of people. So they'll never get past that to get to the real story.
I've considered this 100%, and I believe it. Because I've been immersed in science fiction my whole life, and so I knew exactly where Preston got a lot of that stuff. And he admitted to it, too. Even he said the reptilian commander that he spoke to looked just like the Gorn in Star Trek Arena, right? That was the episode. So, like, going back, it's like, you know, it was all there. Now, another thing I considered was, although these gentlemen were so heavily manipulated, maybe there was some kind of drugs involved, because to diffuse the situation, maybe there was some kind of implanted hallucination or memory to make them think they really did see this stuff, you know, or maybe they really did see this stuff. I don't know. All I know is I truly believe that there were human experiments at that place. And they don't like it that we're talking intelligently about it. I can tell you that much.
So officially, I mean, you got the blueprints that show officially there is nothing. There is no subterranean facility beneath the tower, the radar tower at Camp Hero. But again, you brought in this geological company. They definitely found that there is something under there. You also have eyewitness testimony with video showing that there is something under there. Have you gone back to the Defense Department with this and say, all right, now, you know, your move. What do you make of this?
Yeah, we put in FOIA requests. We have not received anything back, and that's been since the dark file. So, I don't... Anything we get back is going to be redacted. We're not going to... What it's going to require, and they put a great effort forward. I mean, literally, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers was there in droves doing some kind of experiment. They hadn't been there in 13 years. They just happened to be there on the day we had the permit to explore the base, past the fence. We were not allowed past the fence. It was like this big diffusion operation going on to keep us away, and every effort was put forward to keep us away. When I made Montauk Chronicles, it was just me. And my buddy Eric every now and then would help me haul gear out there, and I would hop the fence, and I was there illegally. You know, this is way back when I made my independent film. But when you're doing it for television, you need to get permits. And so they knew exactly when we were going to be there, who was going to be there with us, you know, and there was many efforts to keep us away, especially if we had any scientific equipment. So my suggestion to anybody out there that wants to continue this investigation, try and get your hands on that geophysical equipment.
You also had a CIA op, a former CIA field agent as part of your crew. What did he make? I mean, he was somewhat skeptical, but he seemed to be on side, at least in thinking that the U.S. government was capable of something like that. Very quickly, what did he think?
I believe that Barry Eisler thought there something may have happened there. And I even think in the end, Steve, who was skeptical, believed something may have happened there, but not to the open plane that I have of consideration. But Barry definitely more so than Steve, and believed very much so that it could happen because he was aware of Holmesburg Prison and those experiments. So yes, he was. And when Brian Minnick showed us the photos of the structure that's no longer there, which were the acid rooms where apparently there were experiments, that I think convinced Barry.
We'll talk about the acid room, the Yellow House, when we come back. Filmmaker Christopher Garitano stays with us, and your phone calls as well. A woman has survived after her heart stopped for 6 hours. You heard me correctly, 6 hours. The 34-year-old hiker succumbed to hypothermia after getting caught in a snowstorm in the Pyrenees Mountains. Audrey Showman, who lives in Barcelona, began to experience difficulty talking and moving after the freezing weather closed in during an ill-fated hiking trip in the mountains. Her condition deteriorated while waiting for emergency services to arrive, and by the time doctors were finally able to resuscitate her, she had been technically dead for an incredible 6 hours. Speaking to the BBC's Today program, she said she recalls nothing about the experience. It was much worse for my husband, she said. By the time I came around in hospital, I knew it was serious as my parents were there, but I did not feel like I was at risk of dying, whereas everyone else spent the last few days thinking there was a very good chance I wasn't coming back. Obviously, the cold helped to preserve her vital organs. You can read more about this miracle in the news section, where our webmaster tonight, Lex Lonehood, has posted that and other tantalizing tidbits up at coasttocoastam.com. Back to more of my conversation with filmmaker Christopher Garitano as we continue to discuss Montauk right here on Coast to Coast AM. Let's dive right back into the phone calls, and we'll go to the first-time caller line. Mark is in Tennessee. Mark, good morning. Welcome to Coast. You're on the line with Christopher Garitano. Go ahead.
Hi, Chris. How you doing today? Good, Mark. How are you?
I'm doing fine. I'm a little sort of scared of what to say. I was involved in an incident. I was in the military, and it's not about Montauk, but it has to do with the MK Ultra programs. And some things happened in 1977 in New England, up in Maine and New Hampshire, where a group of military and civilians went on a rampage. And from what I've been able to find out, I mean, it was all hushed up. The newspapers were basically, it went from headline, front page headlines one the first day to maybe a column on the back page the second day and the third day. I mean, it was completely gone out of all the newspapers and TV and everything.
What do you see? What do you mean by they went on a rampage, Mark? What happened?
They took three people hostage in Kerry, Maine. Then the next day came to New Hampshire and came into a birthday party and took 20-something people hostage and tortured me for several hours, almost killed me, and then was taking me out to execute me, and I escaped. And
you're saying the military did this? The military, and they were under some sort of a mind control program?
Yeah, from what I understand, it was it wasn't an MK Ultra, but it was one of the other MK operations.
Right, that was just an umbrella term for a whole host of programs. There was there was Monarch, and there was Artichoke, and others.
They were basically like a group being trained for like a sleeper cell or something like that. This is just stuff I've been able to get from certain individuals. And they came in two agents from, I don't know whether they were CIA or what, but on the third day or on, this happened on a Saturday night before Thanksgiving, and on that Wednesday before Thanksgiving, the day before Thanksgiving, two some kind of agents showed up in the hospital, my hospital room, kidnapped me out of the hospital, had to, basically it was not going to fight all the way from my room out the front doors, and took me to a building, and I was so injured, I was basically, my brain was swelled about three times the size it should have been.
God.
And I was going in and out as they were dragging me down the hallway, and the nurses and doctors were screaming and hollering and trying to find them and get me away from them. And they drug me out and threw me in a car. And after they got me to this building, they interviewed me or debriefed me or whatever you want to call it for several hours. And I was just kept passing out on them, and because I was so messed up. And I really couldn't tell them anything. Because I was so damaged, and I don't remember I don't remember anything where I was from Thanksgiving all the way until the following Monday. So I don't know where they had me, what they did to me, or they drug me out or what, you know. That following Monday, they discharged me out of the military for no reason whatsoever. I mean, I had a completely clean record, had nothing on my record, you know, never even been late to work. And like I said, my records are in some office in, I think, the OSI office in Washington.
Did you ever consider legal action, Mark?
No, I had to sign, they made me sign some papers about national security or something.
Of course, it's always national security.
Sir?
I say it's always national security, isn't it? Let me get Christopher to weigh in on this. I'm sure he finds this not only depressing but also enlightening.
I do, and you know, I'm so sorry you went through that. And it's the story that's once again tantamount to a lot of other people's stories that they've gone through this, and every now and then a new story surfaces, and someone has the courage to talk about it. And I can totally understand that you're afraid to talk about it. Obviously, you're in good company. But yeah, I mean, you know, I grew up reading about stuff like this and seeing it like most of us did in fiction. You know, even a movie like came out in the early 90s, Adrian Lyne's Jacob's Ladder. A very similar situation to what he's just talking about. And, you know, that was in fiction. So where are these ideas coming from?
coming from, I think, some of the authors of this stuff have been told these stories like we're hearing tonight, but in privacy. I don't think they were just imagined. I think this is coming from some very true situations, and that we were, you know, hearing about this in fiction, and now we're hearing about this as reality. And so I don't know. Yeah, it's terrifying because it makes you think of a total lack of security and comfort when we know the people who are supposed to be running the show and taking care of us are not.
Mark in Tennessee, thank you for your service. Thank you for your courage and your story. Let's say hi to Mark is in Fort Myers, Florida on the wild card line. Good morning, Mark.
Hey, good morning or evening, gentlemen. Christopher, you're a brave man. Looking at the radio tower on Daniel Road and the radar tower on Colonel Dunn Road, it is a secluded place. And with a name like Camp Hero preventing you from investigating, they don't want you to be a hero, it seems.
No.
But there is Title 50, Chapter 32, Chemical and Biological Warfare Program, that allows Uncle Sam to experiment on people. I was wondering, did you have any resistance from any specific government agencies like the Department of Agriculture?
Why the Department of Agriculture?
Well, that's what I believe, where the communists got their nose under the tent to take over the country is by taking over the land and the agriculture. And it seems to be an agency, a spurless agency.
All right. Christopher, do you have anything to add to that?
Yeah, well, the resistance came from very local authorities and the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers just being there that kept us from going on the ground. But the very local authorities, I mean town authorities, are the same people that granted us the permit. And even I did an episode of Ancient Aliens in addition to the three other programs I did, which was my independent film, The Dark Files for History Channel and Strange World for Travel. I did an episode of Ancient Aliens, and they did not grant Ancient Aliens the permit for us to go there, which was odd. Yeah, the resistance came from local authorities, security on the base when they knew I was there, and U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, which had field botanists. So I'm not exactly sure the origins of every single person that was in that operation, but there were quite a few.
Mark, thank you for the call. It is interesting that this is a base that was decommissioned, what, 36 years ago, and yet the security remains very, very tight. It's now a national park, but there are these chain link fences around the actual radar tower, and very heavy security presence. One of the locals who was sort of, well, he's provided video evidence to you for this, for some tunnels underneath the tower. He talked about black helicopters and so forth. What, I mean, why would they be, it's a rhetorical question, I guess, but why the security level after it's been closed for nearly 40 years?
Because when we fully discover that there is an underground base there that's been denied all these years, and that opens up a world of questions. Depending on who's at the base, I think that that's what requires a level of security. So when Minnick was a kid, the gentleman you're referring to, I'm sure there was some kind of general, you know, way to keep people out of there. But when they knew we were showing up with geophysicists, that's when the chaos started. You know, that's when they were really freaking out about us being there. Because, you know, a bunch of kids hanging out, which they tend to do in that area, you know, especially since Stranger Things came out, you know, that's drawing people to that base every week. But most people don't have geophysical equipment, nor do they have access to it. So in our case, they knew exactly what we were going there with and who we were bringing there, because you have to submit a list to acquire the permit. And that's when we really experienced the resistance.
All right, this call just popped up on my screen. I want to get to it. First-time caller John is in Mississippi. He lived in Montauk near the Air Force Base from 62 to 72. John, you're on the air with Christopher. Go ahead.
Yes. For one thing, I would just like to say underground at that Air Force Base, it kind of has to be impossible. I mean, we're talking the tip of Long Island, another mile and you're out in the water, not even 500 yards off the edge of the Air Force Base, you're underwater. I don't think it could have been I don't think there could have been anything underneath there. Besides that, when you were talking about possible principals and officials from schools, there was only one school in Montauk. It's still there, Montauk Public School. I went to from kindergarten to eighth grade, and I know both of the principals, and that I'm going to discount whatever you were talking about them recruiting.
The gentleman I spoke to didn't go to the Montauk schools. He went to a school in Southampton.
Well, it could have been another school from maybe Amagansett, East Hampton, Southampton, West Hampton, wherever, but Montauk was by itself. We're 16 miles from the Hamptons, even though they consider us the Hamptons.
But John, Christopher he brought a geological company on site, and they found something underneath the tower.
If they found something, I don't know how they built it, because, like I said, we lived a mile and a half from there. I could see the radar moving when I was a child. I mean, there was forts all over that island, I guess back way before I was even born, but, you know, for our protection. But the Air Force Base had a lot of funny things happening, and I remember one time I was 12, 68. Where I lived, I was 500 yards from the beach, Ditch Plains Road. There used to be an old Coast Guard tower there, and it was just concrete. And we used to use coal and just draw roads on that. We used to skateboard on that. Back when I was skateboarding at that age, we had steel wheels still. But I remember one day especially, myself, my sister, and my two cousins, we were skateboarding that day. It was very foggy. And we're not 100 yards from the water. I could hear the beach. I could hear the sound of the waves, but you couldn't see anything. It was so foggy. Montauk was very foggy in the morning a lot. Something came over us. It had to be at least 300 to 400 feet long. There was two red lights. And when it came over us, it was silent. I could feel the wind. I threw a rock at it. We ran back to our houses, and then it was gone. But
You're saying it yourself, John. There's something really weird happening out there, you know?
Yes. This is back, you know, when the Air Force Base was still going on. I mean, I used to know a few kids that used to go to school that their parents were, you know, based at the Air Force Base. But that was a freaky thing that happened to us back then. And that's the first time I've ever told anybody that, to be honest with you.
Well, and we appreciate you. We appreciate you calling in with that, John. Thank you so much. What's up next on, what are you going to tackle next on the TV show?
Well, I wanted to, improve on the show. Otherwise I don't want to do it. And I know other people involved want that as well. And so I submitted a bunch of different things. And one of which I'm tackling right now in a motion picture I'm making called In Ink by Andromeda the Great. And it covers all of this hidden conspiracy. It's about a whistleblower who is suffering from my version, which is very close to reality, of Morgellons disease, which we recently found out because many people were told that they had this thing and they were imagining it. And now it's being proven that it was real. And the origins were by weaponized ticks, insects, that were given this thing, and it was transferred into people, and they're starting to prove it to be real. And that this was once total conspiracy. The people that had Morgellons were told they were lunatics, and now it's being proven to be true. And so I'm writing a somewhat of a science fiction tale about this type of paranoia that someone's going through who's being told that it is not real. And so it questions reality, and I'm bringing all of that into this motion picture and in the show. And Strange World Season 2, we're going to cover a lot of other things, and I don't want it to be pure entertainment and just loose scripts and running around saying the same old thing. I want us to really investigate. I want us to expose things if we can.
Chris, God bless you for what you're doing, and I guess my only advice is maybe consider, and I'm not being trite here, maybe you need to consider about hiring someone to start your car in the morning, because you are cutting very close to the bone here, my friend. I'm serious.
I know. I thought about that for many years, but at the same time, I'm just, I don't know. It's compelling me to move forward. So I'm doing it.
Well, thank you for your service, my friend. Christopher Garitano, thanks a lot for this. We made it. We made it to the finish line, and you got it set. Well done.
Thanks, Richard. Thank you very much.
All right. When we come back, Lee Harvey Oswald, was he a doppelganger? My guest says yes, and he will provide some very compelling evidence.